You are listening to Rochester Indie Media. My name is Ted Forsyth. This is part two of a workshop called Ending the Fabrication of the War on Terror, Lessons from Africa, given by Horace Campbell on April 27, 2013, in Syracuse, New York, at the Resisting Drones Global War and Empire Convergence. Part two is a discussion portion of the workshop. Part one, the video of Horace's comments before the discussion, can be found at our website, rochester.indymedia, that's I-N-D-Y-M-E-D-I-A .org. Thanks for listening to Rochester Indie Media.
Go ahead.
Me?
Yeah, no.
Could you clarify again, please, that Israel, Saudi, Qatar, where they're positioned and where we're positioned in reference to
Israel, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia.
You've excluded the ICC from your discussion. I wondered if you bring that in. The role.
Okay. I'll answer.
You've also asked numerous times, where was the peace movement? And I guess one of the answers to that is mired in ignorance of a lot of the things, and I'm reminded of a quote that I heard from William Casey, former CIA director, who said, we will know when our disinformation campaign has been effective when everything that U.S. citizens understand is wrong. And so one of the great challenges that we as citizens have, whether or not we're part of the peace movement or not, is being able to access accurate, truthful information.
Yes.
So if you could make some suggestions.
And we have a statement on the table that very clearly states our position. And I think it's really important that the anti-drone movement realizes that drones are just the technology. But the wars that are going on right now are the ones we have to oppose, and the ones they're threatening we have to strongly oppose, and not buy bullshit about humanitarian intervention, etc. We must be for non-intervention, we must be for self-determination, and we must be taking that position consistently. There's no sometimes it's okay and sometimes it's not.
Thank you. Let me take those four and then I'll come around for another round. The question of Israel, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia. Some people might find it strange that this is an alliance today. But this alliance is born out of the need for a more overt war against Iran. There is a war going on against Iran right now. And the peace movement has been basically silent on this war. This war against Iran is going on in three ways. One, economic sanctions. Two, cyber warfare. And three, creating terrorist organization in eastern Iran. So there's a war going on, and it's propped up primarily by the neoconservatives in Israel in alliance with the United States Pentagon. And I would say, when I talk about the Pentagon now, I'm very clear that there's a war inside the Pentagon. In fact, some of you don't know that Obama has just fired General James Mattis from the head of the Central Command because James Mattis wanted a war with Iran right away. And he replaced him with Lloyd Austin because Obama said, we are not going to escalate the war against Iran. And I think it's important for us to follow this minutiae that is going on in relationship to situations like Iran. Saudi Arabia, that is a very conservative government, that its political base is very narrow, and they inside that regime has elements that is inside and outside that government that are called Wahhabis. And they support a branch of Sunni Muslim and Sunni Islam that meets the military and political needs of the neocons in the United States of America, to the point that when the head of Blackwater was running away from the United States of America, he found a base among those forces in the Emirates. So it is that alliance between Saudi Arabia, Qatar, sections of Kuwait, and Israel that they say we want to overthrow the Shiites in Iran. Now, one does not have to support the Iranian government, but if you have a war in Iran, it is not going to end in Iran. This is what we mean by we say we must remember what happened in 1935 in the attack of Abyssinia by the Italians and how that led to World War II. We are in this situation now since the invasion of Libya in 2011. So we cannot be silent with that wing of the Israeli right wing in alliance with the right wing in the United States and the right wing in France. And I want to stress, there's a new book that I want to suggest to, apart from my own book, this book, it just came out, The Dying Sahara. This book is about the fabrication of terrorism in North Africa, because the United States of America have been supporting these forces in North Africa. And then we have this coup. So the whole entire situation is based on intelligence manipulation to create a situation of instability in North Africa. And this is why I did not hear a statement from the peace movement about the French invasion of Mali. Okay, one branch. Okay, so let me take the other question on the International Criminal Court. In fact, we just had a session on Thursday on the International Criminal Court. One of our colleagues, she's writing a book about the International Criminal Court. There's a great divisions within Africa about this. Because in Africa...
Let me just say I live in Kenya.
Okay.
I'm here in Syracuse visiting my 88-year-old mother.
Yeah, we met before.
I think we did.
Yes. And the discussion about the ICC, we need to take a minute on this.
We had kick-ass politics in Kenya where we just elected Uhuru Kenyatta.
Yes.
He wasn't my horse in the race.
Yeah.
But he's indicted by the criminal court.
Yes. Well, the International Criminal Court has discredited itself because the only people who have been taken before the criminal court are Africans.
Right.
So we have to ask ourselves, in this planet of 7 billion persons, it is the only Africans that are committing crimes against humanity. And so there's a division within Africa about the criminal court. Now, I am partial because my view of the International Criminal Court is like that of my colleague who say we should expand the International Criminal Court so that the International Criminal Court can try crimes against companies.
But Americans are not signatories.
Oh, I'm going to come to that. I'm going to come to that. They're not signatories now, but the coming into being of the International Criminal Court took 40 years. From Nuremberg until the Rome Statutes were signed in 1998. We in the peace and justice movement must have our eyes on the future. When leaders such as Goldman Sachs, head of Shell Corporation and BP can be brought before the International Criminal Court. And therefore, I'm not joining with those Africans who are opposed to the International Criminal Court. I am opposed to them indicting only Africans and using it, but that is a temporary situation because I'm very clear now that Africa is going to be the major force in world politics after this depression and war. I'm very clear now after I studied what happened in 1935, and therefore we must lay the foundations for what happens after that. We must have a new international system, and the International Criminal Court must be part of this. Prendergast came to the university to speak 2 weeks ago, and I asked him, do you support signing the Rome Statutes? He said yes, because the United States liberals want to have their cake and eat it. The liberals in the United States want to talk about humanitarianism and the rule of law, and yet they will not take a position to say the United States should sign on to the Rome Statutes. So I'm glad you asked a question about the ICC, because the ICC, like terrorism, is one of those things manipulated as part of the psychological warfare. Which brings me to your question. Psychological warfare is the main form of warfare. And the reason it is so dangerous now, it is destroying our children. I was in the plane recession this morning, and I looked, and I said, what is the average age of the people in this meeting on peace?
Oh, no.
Where are our children?
Working.
Why is it that we in the peace movement, we do not have the language, we don't have the thinking, we don't have the organization to get to those young people? But the Pentagon can get them to sign on 100 million to say they're going to go to save Kony. So we should be having self-reflection about what we're doing. Why is it we do not have the language and the tactics to reach those young people? Because psychological warfare is to destroy the minds of our young people. Look at what happened in Boston last week. This 19-year-old boy. And then to use that to turn it against Americans by saying these boys are terrorists and that they were influenced by what happened in Chechnya. These are young boys trained in the confusion in the United States of America. We must take responsibility that this is the mess that's created by our gun culture and this terrorism against the population. And to add to this, the racism that says, yes, this was done by some dark-skinned people. So the media is complicit. So the media is in what Rumsfeld called for terrorism and psychological warfare against the United States. So what Casey started, they'll take to a higher level. The reason I'm so confident is that they cannot win in Africa in terms of psychological warfare. That's why they can't win in the United States of America. Because in Africa, when the United States come to Africa and say, we're fighting a war on terror, Africans say, really?
Yeah.
Well, we remember when Nelson Mandela was a terrorist. Yeah. And Ben Laden was your freedom fighter. So what has changed? So we know that psychological warfare has no... So the Africans, I'm not worried about Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab. I'm worried about where I am. That's why when I hear Jeremy Scale talking about this terrorism and Africa, I say, are you buying into the psychological warfare of the Pentagon? Because the peace movement cannot be going on about this big thing about Africa, the hotbed of terrorism and war. Africa has the 7 fastest growing economies, and Africa is at the forefront of transforming. But they want to fight the war against China in Africa. That's what's going on. The fourth question. What was the fourth question? About Syria. Okay, you're making a comment. It was no question. Go ahead, let's take your question.
Well, I was surprised you didn't mention the Congo. And my other comment is, if I may, why don't we all in the peace movement take our money out of the banks? Why don't we get all the musicians who sing fabulous things, you know, to take their money out of the banks and put them into credit unions?
Let me repeat for those who don't know what she said. She said, what about the Congo? What should be the position of the peace movement on the Congo? And why don't we take money out of the banks? I'll say something about that. Let's take 2 or 3 more.
Yeah, first of all, I want to thank you for your comments. I think they're important comments that we all need.
Could I stand up so that it's over here?
No, thank you for your comments. I think they're important that we all need to hear. And you mentioned how now what we're doing is we're fighting with, you know, special operations and drones because we can't invade another country. And I agree with that. But Obama started with trying to invade another country. He started with the surge in Afghanistan, which was a total failure. And, you know, now he's more into drones and special operations and third parties, which I think is important, because one thing it says is we have had some success in the anti-war movement, that we have helped stay the hand. And the other thing which I think is important that you said was when you talked about Mali and Africa and why the peace movement can't grasp that. And it's also having a hard time grasping Syria and Iran and North Korea, which were targets. People have to understand that the U.S. doesn't go in there to bring democracy anywhere, and people can't get democracy in these countries until the U.S. leaves. And one other aspect of the kind of racism is this board right here, where the anti-war movement has not really taken up the issue to any great extent, with some exceptions, of the Muslims that have been attacked in this country and around the world to build up a site of racism. These are people, Muslims, who've had, the FBI goes into their mosques and sets them up and puts them in jail and says, see, Muslims are terrible, so we can conduct these wars overseas, but also at home, in terms of attacks on our own civil liberties, which is also significant.
Thank you.
You put forward the theory that World War II was started because of an economic response to the Great Depression. I read it more necessarily as nationalistic Germany rising out of the ashes of the Weimar Republic, and then Japan naturally responding from finally like emerging to be a westernized nation to compete with the other westernized nations that for so many years exploited them. But what I don't understand, though, is if you advance the theory that World War II was fought based on economic reasons, Germany, England, France, and Soviet Union, the United States all overlap in terms of being industrial power plants. Meanwhile, China right now is an industrial economy, while the United States is more of a service economy. China also gets a lot of their food from production within the United States. If the government is so intelligent to be able to like wage a war simply for economic reasons, would they be intelligent enough to realize that a war with China would probably be more economically detrimental than World War II would have been?
Okay, thank you. Okay, let's take the last one first, because let's think about the economic foundations of World War II. It's been obscured because inside many sections, they do not grasp the dangers of capitalism and imperialism. I would really urge you to read a book by Ernest Mandel called The Meaning of the Second World War. The Meaning of the Second World War. The triggers of war started, as I told you, with currency wars, trade wars, financial wars, and devaluations. We're actually there now. In fact, psychological warfare means we don't call it a depression. We do not call it devaluation, we call it quantitative easing. And we've been through the third round of quantitative easing, which devalues the United States currency by 15%. And the point is that the United States currency is the reserve currency of the world, and therefore everybody have to keep their currency in the dollar. This is the present cause of the war we're in now. In World War II, they talk about German nationalism, but German nationalism was egged on by the German capitalist class. Siemens, Krupp, and the big corporations supported the nationalists. The nationalists did not come to power on their own behalf. Now, when it comes to war with China, what is the thinking behind the militarists in the United States and behind the division in the United States of America? The thinking is as follows. We had a difference with the Soviet Union. In the Soviet Union, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the economy of the Soviet Union shrunk by a third. China is overtaking the United States. There's nothing to stop it. And so how would we stop China overtaking the United States of America? Well, the way to stop the United States being overtaken is to use our military superiority at the moment to destroy China. And the way you use your military superiority is to use electromagnetic pulse weapons, EMP weapons, war from space, and to shut down all of the electronics. That is the thinking of the right wing inside the United States military. And they want to create a creeping war which will encircle China to the point where they fight a war with China. Now, the Chinese ruling class, they go by the theory that the best way to fight your enemy is not to fight them, but let them wear themselves out. So that is my view about the relationship with the United States and China. Let me answer her question and you can make a retort. About the Congo. I've not mentioned Europe a lot in my presentation because Europe is basically finished. In fact, what is really happening in Europe now is our big challenge is to stop fascism in Europe. European capitalism has reached the point where the European ruling class does not have the means of holding back the capitalists from Wall Street in alliance with the capitalists inside of Europe. And they have gone ahead with this thing called austerity against the European working class. And in the response to this, the conservative racists are whipping up xenophobia, racism, and jingoism, so that in a place like Greece, we have something like the New Dawn Party. So what we'll have to do is to see how this racism and fascism is developing in Europe. It is the Europeans who for 100 years depended on Africa that want to break up the Congo. But I don't think they've succeeded. The African
Union... The U.S.
The CIA killed Lumumba, and the CIA has continued to work in the Congo. But the situation has changed significantly in Africa because the most significant event at the end of the 20th century in Africa was ending of apartheid. And so the ending of apartheid is laying the foundations. I'm not saying that the war in the Congo is going to end next year or a year after, but the pressures for African unity, and I say the invasion of Libya and what's happening in Mali is even strengthening the pressures for African unity to get rid of external intervention. So the inside the United States of America, the Clinton wing of the bourgeoisie, along with the Europeans, are the ones who are supporting Rwanda to divide the Congo. But well, for the next 3 years, Clinton is out. And we hope that you won't come back anywhere inside the politics of the United States of America.
Right,
okay,
right.
Let's take those two comments there.
Why is the economic inequality in South Africa worse now than it was during the apartheid movement, if the apartheid movement was so good for South Africa? Why is Northern Europe and Germany probably the most two sustainable, like Northern Europe and Germany, the two of the most sustainable economies in the world right now? And thirdly, why would the United States be worried about China rising as a superpower to overtake us in terms of economic size when we deal in completely different parts of the market? When China is a service economy, or China is an industrial economy that helps, that provides products to the United States, which then we buy. We're so heavily interlocked, it seemed like it'd just be economic folly to go to war.
Okay, thank you.
Building off of that, China is not yet anything like this country or the European Union, which you've sort of written off. They're the second biggest economy, and barely, to the United States when operating together. They have more soft power than any other economic bloc in the entire world. Not to mention China, like he's saying about China. They haven't converted yet. They have a bunch of rural peasants at the base of their economy who, once they have develop a middle class, you're talking about a nation that cannot continue politically the way it has. They're going to have to morph into something more democratic. And it's totally not the game. You know, you're predicting this China is sort of staying where it is now, and that's the country we're going to be dealing with. But in 30 years, China's going to be completely different. It's going to change rapidly and suddenly. And we have to embrace what kind of where their economy is going to go, and their growth rates right now, totally not sustainable. Lots of developing countries have hit those rates, and as soon as they become first-tier countries, they slow down to the standard 1-2% of GDP growth every year.
China also grew by those astounding rates because of the influx of labor, because they had so many rural peasants they were translating into the economy.
And my currency.
Just to add to that, could you also talk a little bit about how Chinese presence in countries like South Africa has actually destroyed the economies of those countries by filling the markets with cheap goods that are undervalued because of the Chinese currency.
Yeah, just very briefly, the United States has had interest in Africa since the 19th century. They sent two representatives to the Berlin Conference in 1884 because once they had consolidated all this land here for Native Americans, et cetera, still half of Mexico, then it began to look overseas to see what they could get. And World War I was a competition between European nations, specifically Germany and England, over which one shall dominate Africa. And then Israel supported apartheid in South Africa.
Yeah.
They sent General Mordecai Hardy in 67 to lecture to them about the Six-Day War at the South African Military Academy. And Nelson Mandela, I try to give him a little credit, say he just didn't know any better, but South Africa has not been basically any better under Mandela or the other two presidents, because he just put a few black faces in white places and shared some of the wealth, but white still owns the majority of the wealth in South Africa.
Okay. Have you seen any signs in Africa, all of Africa, of a different economic system working other than your capitalistic viewpoint?
Yes. Let me take them one at a time. First, the question of inequality in South Africa. It's true that the South African state and the capitalist class in South Africa have consolidated since the end of apartheid, and that the black capitalists in South Africa have joined with the white capitalists in South Africa. But be very careful. Even while you make that critique, there is no comparison between the South Africa of today and the South Africa of apartheid. If you do that, then you do not understand what a tremendous change occurred in Africa by overthrowing apartheid. Because the apartheid government was like a locust destroying all of Southern Africa. So I will make that critique. Today, the South African government is giving an award to Forbes Burnham of Guyana. And we've mobilized for the past 2 weeks attacking the South African government. But I have contradictions with the South African government, but I'm also very clear of what the situation is in the world today. So I would want to say that I agree with your point, but I work with people in South Africa to make South Africa better. Second point about Germany. I'm patient enough to see the evolution of this capitalist crisis in Europe. But I'm not going to be patient to the point of being silent on the rise of xenophobia and racism within Europe. So whether Germany is going to remain strong and France is going to remain strong is not my problem. My problem at the moment is the rise of racism against immigrants, against Muslims, and the rise of xenophobia inside of Europe that the peace movement has to take a position on. And I know that the European capitalism for 100 years rested on the economic exploitation of Africa. I've dealt with this at great length in my book. And if you want to understand this, read a book called How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. One of the things that precipitate the weakening of Europe is the entrance of China in the world economy. Now, the question of China and Chinese socialism. What is the position of the peace movement on China? Our position on the peace movement on China is that on all times, our language, our activities, and our mobilization must be to align ourselves with those elements in China that will make life better for the Chinese. I want to give you four areas where that is possible. Number one, the environmental justice movement in China is a movement that is saying that the Chinese capitalist class is destroying the environment. So you don't attack China, you attack the capitalists in China and align yourself with the environmentalists in China. Two, the low wages for the Chinese workers. In Africa, When we see Chinese, we say, we want you to get as much rights as workers have. That is why the struggle for collective bargaining, the struggle for the rights of workers, must go to the Chinese. Thirdly, in terms of trying to dismember China by encircling China, we as the peace movement must be sophisticated enough that we align ourselves with those forces that can ensure that the land of the peasantry in China is not being taken away, because there are over 80,000 rebellions in China every year. And the quality of those rebellions would be enhanced if they know that there's an international movement for peace, justice, and environmental rights. So I am not going to take any position against China. I'll take a position against the Chinese capitalist class that's exploiting the Chinese. Let me take two other points. I think that the point that was made about Islam, I want to reinforce that point. Islamophobia is being used by the right-wing Christian conservatives in this country. And Islamophobia is part of what is driving the war on terror. And so I appreciate the point that was being made here. Are you leaving? Yes. I appreciate it. I want to say that within the mosques, the FBI has been going in to set up people, and we need to get more information about what the FBI knew about these two young boys, because it seems that the FBI had relations with them. And in our community, we have Julie, you can say something about Dr. Dafir. Yes, within our community.
There's a workshop on this issue of Islamophobia next.
Okay.
Yes, with Steve Downs.
Okay,
the lawyer
fine, fine. Okay, so let's take another round. And by the way, my book is only $15 at this conference, $20 usually, and I'll sign it. It's about global NATO and the catastrophic failure in Libya. Let's take some more comments.
I wanted to reinforce what I think that gentleman said earlier, that I think it would help all of us if we got recommendations from you about resources and where we can keep up on a more day-to-day basis of good information about Africa and all of these issues.
Recommendations. Well, apart from my own book, this book by Jeremy Keenan, U.S. Imperialism and Terror in Africa, The Dying Sahara. He had a book before that called The Dark Sahara. We have an organization called Association of Concerned African Studies. So we have a website, ACAS. And we have a group that is calling for demilitarizing Africa. And I have launched a campaign calling Dismantling Africa. And I believe everybody should be involved in this campaign, because the creation of the U.S. Africa Command is destroying United States university systems. The U.S. Africa Command does not have itself troops. In fact, the primary task of the U.S. Africa Command is to control social science research on Africa, because they're in this for the long haul. So I would say that wherever you are in the peace movement, among your group, create a group to dismantle AFRICOM. Link up with ACAS, Pambazuka, is a website that is out of London, that they think, and then to link up with African groups and African organizations. There are many such groups in Africa, in Europe, and in the United States. They just do not have the resources that the Pentagon and the CIA have to carry out information warfare.
From how much U.S. capital is invested now in China, to the extent that if the United States and the capitalists would do anything to hurt China, to what extent would they hurt themselves?
Okay. The question is, how much capital is invested in China that if the United States have a war with China, they will hurt themselves? Well, for the long-term planners, not enough. Because if you remember, in 1935, the United States had a lot of capital invested in Germany. IBM was in Germany, Ford was in Germany. So at the moment when the capitalist crisis matures, and the maturation of that crisis reached the point where it comes to a confrontation, they will sweep even the government aside. I want to say again, since 2008, the United States has devalued its currency by 15 to 17%. The United States currency is the reserve currency of most countries in the world. Most of those countries are seeking ways to diversify and take their money out of the US currency. The military management of the world economy is what backs up the US currency at the moment. Before 1971, it was backed up by gold. And so the capitalist class in the United States have no alternative but to go to war to maintain the dominance of the United States at the moment. That is why we have to be clear to understand what is driving this war.
This is a touchy question, but I'd like to ask it. There is you, there was Howard Zinn, there is Noam Chomsky. There are very, very few academics who either dare or know how to tell the truth as it is. Why is that? Why do people stop talking when they talk about, say, for example, resource nationalism, which is a key issue all over Africa today? Resource nationalism.
Yes. Well, as I said, they have the thing called the War on Terror, and we have AFRICOM. I said the primary job of the United States Africa Command is to control social science research on Africa. So if you want to do research on Africa today, you have to go through some organization, some funding agency that's controlled by the Pentagon. In other words, money has dried up for social science research. And young researchers who are starting out their academic career, who want to get tenure, want to get promotion, want to get their jobs, they're going to toe the line. They're going to talk about governance, sustainable development, aid for Africa, humanitarianism, and how to bring about end of terrorism in Africa. And all of that language and discourse feeds into imperialism. That the governance and humanitarianism, all part of imperialism now. So when you hear someone talk about reform in Africa, you know that's imperialism talking.
Absolutely.
So the challenge for the peace movement is, I went to the First Nation peoples yesterday, and the clan mother, Frida Jack, she said, peace is active. Peace is not something that you just do because you want. It's active thinking and working about how to get an alternative society. And so, yes, in Tanzania, Ujamaa by Nyerere was an attempt to conceptualize an alternative mode of economic organization. Ujamaa was a way of thinking through new forms of economic life in Africa. It was, but the World Bank and the IMF destroyed it. The IMF and World Bank is now finished because the IMF and World Bank do not have as much money as China. In fact, the World Bank lent $101 billion and China lent $109 billion. So we are on the threshold of something very new. The question is, how do we work towards it? Let's take the question in the back, then this one here.
How much of an influence on the progression towards war do you think the dwindling resources of the world, from timber to energy to gravel to air and water, and needing those resources to be spread over an ever-increasing population, how much do you think that will influence a tendency to war, regardless of who the players are, regardless of what capitalist interests are present at the time?
You are representative of those small minority of professors that would be honored to be in your class, but there's not a single school in the world that I would go to get my definition of an education. And my youngest brother has 2 PhDs and 3 master's degrees. From his view, and many other people, he's educated. From my view, he's indoctrinated. Education is when you're able to look at the world from your particular perspective, and not the perspective of the master.
Okay, let's take the question of resources. I am not one of those who believe we have a resource problem. I do not think there's a resource problem. I believe there's a problem of the distribution of what's in the world. In other words, we have enough oil, we have enough water, we have enough food. The question is how the world is organized. So the distribution question, and some people on the left talk about resource wars. Africa has the cleanest water, abundance of water, the largest aquifer in the world. It's like an ocean. It's under the Libyan desert. The largest in the world. So there's no shortage of water in Africa. The question is, France and Germany want to take control of that water. So the problem about resource and fighting over resources, that is part of the disinformation that's going on.
You talked about disinformation, and one of the issues there's no question but what the events of 9/11 were fed into this and inspired what we now call the global war on terrorism. And I was suspicious about the collapse of those buildings, had questions about it, and still do, and I found that I'm not alone and that there are many now professional organizations that have the same thing. Now, if you raise that issue, you're labeled, looked at askance and considered a conspiracy theorist, which, I mean, you might be too for offering alternative explanations for some of the things that have been going on in Africa. So that's always something that I think it was Schopenhauer that said the truth is, first it's ridiculed and then it's first it's laughed at, then it's ridiculed or something, and finally it's accepted as self-evident. There's a real battle that has to be waged here to get at the truth. And I'm just wondering if you have an opinion on those events, since you're so critical in many other respects.
Okay.
Of 9/11, the collapse of those buildings, particularly.
Okay, Judy?
I'm going to pass because I was listening to all these other questions, and I lost track of my own thoughts, so move on. I'll raise my hand again.
Okay. They say we have 5 minutes left. But about 9/11, the question for the peace movement is not about the conspiracy about 9/11. It's about the war that has been waged from that time to destroy Afghanistan, Iraq, and now Libya, Mali, Somalia. In other words,
Syria.
And Pakistan.
Iran is in the sights.
The peace movement have to be more proactive to stop war. And I'm suggesting that one of the things we have to intensify is intensify this work to divide the United States military. We have to intensify the work against the very conservative forces like James Mattis, who go before Obama and said, here is my war plan for Iran, why are you going along with it? And we have to be conscious about these battles that are going on at the moment. Let's take one last comment.
Two things. One was about what you just described about dividing the military, and I think that was one of the things that defeated the U.S. in Vietnam, was that the military was from within rebelled. And the other thing that I thought you might speak to is South America as a model for the kind of direction that AFRICOM can take, which is that they, Africa. And that basically the South Americans, after being completely beaten down, dropped out of the system. And so the World Bank no longer had power because they said, sorry, we aren't going to pay you. and reform within themselves. And I think that I see that as sort of what, you know, the possibilities are for Africa, at least initially, to regain their own power, you know, the countries here regain their own power. Yes.
Thank you for that point. And I would like to add that apart from the Vietnam War, the same thing happened with John Brown and Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass. That Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman, they didn't go around and attack Abraham Lincoln. They focused on what the enemy was. And it led to the division within the United States military. And WikiLeaks has pointed out that there are courageous young people like Bradley Manning, and there are hundreds of young people in the United States military who are against these private military contractors. And nobody in the peace movement is saying, why is there no registration of the private military contractors? Why is it the State Department does not tell us how many of these private military contractors are working, where they're working, what are they doing, and why is it that the United States embassies have to be protected by private military contractors such as Blackwater, that has now changed its name to Z, and has changed its name to something else. So there's a lot of work for us to do. Let us not be asleep at the wheel and have our children sign on the petition like Kony 2012, where that is clearly disinformation to serve the US military. Thank you very much.